You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. Today on the program, from the great blog Hullabaloo, the great blogger Digby, on just about everything in the news. Meanwhile, the debate last night, boring. Crappy debate for many reasons. We'll talk about that later. But Mitt Romney packaged in a wonderful little sort of like a chocolate box. Mitt Romney released his taxes today, but just from 2010. Some interesting things in there. Apparently, he's very wealthy. And apparently, he pays, and I have to say, I don't know if I said this on the program last week, but I said it in the green room. I was on Tom Hartman's RT program, RT America program, Thursday night. And I was on with a woman from the American Techs I can't remember what the group was. And she said Romney's effective rate is 15%. I said, no, it's not. His marginal rate might be 15%, but his effective rate will be lower than that. In fact, 13.9. Now you're saying, what's 1.1% between friends? 1.1% of 21 million? 24 million, I think it was. His earnings in 2010 or 2009, excuse me, 2010, let's see. That's over $100. And so that's a lot of money to me. And the most interesting thing about Romney's taxes, aside from the fact that he's paying a tax rate that I am sure none of you are, and aside from the fact that that difference between 13.9 and 15% alone, never mind difference between 15% and 28%, could fund this program for years. All of you would get it for free. I don't think that's where the money would go if we were collecting legitimate taxes on Romney's fortunes. But it would probably pay for, I don't know, several dozen teachers. So Mitt Romney releases his taxes. Last night he also tried to, we'll talk more about the debate with Digby. Rick Santorum, another day, something offensive comes out of his mouth. We will talk about how Santorum really believes that, you know, when you're raped, you make lemonade out of your lemons, out of your rape lemons. Also, yesterday, a memo dug up by Ryan Lizza at New Yorker magazine gives us some insight into how President Obama's economic team decided on the stimulus number. I raise it
Much of it is, of course, water under the bridge. But I raise it because yesterday I was on Radigan. I followed Jonathan Alter, who I've had multiple arguments on air as to what the Obama administration should have or could have done in terms of the stimulus. And despite the fact that he apparently has written a book on the Obama administration, or maybe not in spite of the fact, his defense of the Obama administration turns out to have been not quite accurate. We'll talk about that more. Also, because on that same show, I was on with David Stockman, who I last saw on that program, when he was talking about the fact that the United States was about to fold. We were weeks away from a total implosion because PIMCO had shorted U.S. Treasury bonds. This was nearly a year ago. And he was on the program. I just found the whole exchange rather annoying as they go on about Fannie and Freddie Mac causing the financial meltdown. We will revisit again this zombie lie because the zombie lie will not die. Also, some good news coming out of the West Coast. The longshoremen and their battle with a union-breaking shipping company aided by the Occupy movement. It looks like we got a victory there. The U.S. Government underestimated, sounds like purposely, or I should say understated, the size of the BP spill. California, is it on the verge of single payer? If you're from California, continue to listen to this program. We will give you information. You can find it on the site at Majority FM on where to pressure your lawmakers. What starts in California often goes west. I remember that with skateboards. Skateboards and Zumbas and inline skating. There's been a bunch of stuff that travels in that direction. And President Obama has now, I believe, doubled the amount of whistleblowers that he has prosecuted under the Espionage Act than all of the presidents in the history of the United States combined.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hoodlay, hoodlay, hoo-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hoodlay, hoodlay.
We needed some type of greater fanfare for that, but I couldn't muster it. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby from the blog Hullabaloo right after this.
I turned my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way. On the way, the waves slipping away. I turned my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah, and you wasn't mine.
We are back, Sam Cedar. On the Majority Report, on the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo. I'm, of course, talking about Digby. Welcome to the program, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
The debate, when I sent you an email the other day to book you, I thought maybe we'd be wanting to talk about the debate. But I found the debate really bad. And sort of even more pathetic because you got 17 of these to get a sense of how these things are going to go. And I just thought the debate was just boring.
Oh, it was the worst one by far. And, you know, of course, Newt, he's complaining this morning because they wouldn't let the audience cheer in bloodlust, which is really, I suppose, what's made these debates a little bit more interesting than they otherwise would have been, and certainly that seems to fuel him. I mean, he was flat as a pancake last night.
Well, I thought, I sort of agree with him, but my feeling was like, if you're going to be NBC and you're going to be Brian Williams and you're going to try and make this a dignified affair and less about sort of cheering and more about policy, then you know what you should do is ask some policy questions.
No kidding. No kidding. Yeah. I mean, and they could have. I mean, there was, you know, they ended up talking about, you know, their respective taxes and who paid what and, you know, and all that. Not that that isn't interesting, specifically in terms of Mitt, who did release his, and turns out he pays a 13.5% tax rate, which is good to know, considering that he's, you know, an excessively wealthy person. So, you know, that's interesting. But beyond
that,
I
want to,
you know,
talk about that. But Brian Williams' question was, your taxes are coming out tomorrow. Is there anything in there that we should will surprise us? What kind of question is that?
I don't know. Yes, it will surprise you to learn just how productive I really am as a citizen, Brian. Thanks for asking.
That's what a lame, lame question. I mean, I was just sort of like stunned at how, you know, Brian Williams must have people working for him, right? I mean, it's not like he had to make these questions up on the fly. He was bad. I thought the woman from the National Journal, I can't remember her name, I thought she had some decent questions.
Yeah, everybody were a little bit more specific anyway.
Yeah, it was really bad. And I suspect that Newt is waiting until the next debate, which is Thursday night, before he attacks Romney. I think he's smart enough to know that the last debate is going to be the one that wins.
Right, and I also think that he can feel assured that they're going to let the audience go wild, because
right.
Piers Morgan tweeted last night, you know, wait till you see the CNN debate. If you know, we won't let this happen or something. So, you know, CNN wants the bloodlust to show as well. It makes for better television for sure.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think we know how lunatic fringe the candidates are. The really interesting thing is to watch how lunatic fringe the Republican base is, because at the end of the day, you know, you got Mitt Romney, who seems to have no compass whatsoever. These are the people who are going to be dictating the terms of his presidency if it's our misfortune to have him. But let's talk about this tax thing, because Romney cannot answer this question without looking like he's literally just been caught, naked in like a parking lot or something.
Oh, well, I mean, look, I've sort of come to the conclusion that Mitt Romney is the worst candidate for this particular time period. Now, it seems on paper we're all making the assumption, well, of course he's going to win the nomination and, you know, maybe he'll give Obama run for his money because he's a moderate, you know, he's got a moderate background that will appeal to some independents, blah, 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 the usual analysis. But the truth is there couldn't be a worse candidate. Yeah. This guy is the very personification of the 1%. He is everything that, you know, people are, whether consciously or subconsciously, know have caused this economic downturn. I mean, even the ones who were fooling themselves into believing it was Fannie and Freddie, you know, Romney invested in them too. I mean, you know, it's not like he's everything about him is wrong. He is, Greg Sargent referred to him this morning as an out-of-touch fop, which I think is, you know, a good way of putting it. And, you know, there is nothing about him that is right for this particular moment. It's not to say that a rich guy couldn't win. You know, they've won in the past. Many of our presidents have been wealthy. But to have the wealthy one be the one still, you know, be the one clamoring for tax cuts for the wealthy, it just doesn't track. And, you know, I think that's one reason why, even among Republicans, aside from the red meat that Newt offers them, I mean, they've also turned for Santorum. There have been moments for all these candidates because the guy is just wrong. He's just wrong. They know he's wrong. And yet he has so much money and so much power within the party, even though, you know, they're not that thrilled with him either, that it's like he's inevitable, which is, you know, it's kind of a metaphor for our for our central problem of our political system.
Yeah.
You can't stop the guy even though nobody likes him.
The frustrating part about it, and I'm hoping, and I want to move to this in a bit, but we still have some stuff to talk about with Romney, is that I hope that President Obama, and I know that this, even to use the word hope in the context of President Obama at this point makes me feel a little bit distressed, but there's a big opportunity here for Mitt Romney to become a metaphor, and that this to be a launching pad for a larger discussion. Now, we saw, his Kansas City speech. We also saw his chief economic advisor, I think it was last week, Krueger, talk about income inequality. But, you know, to tackle the idea that, like, why is Mitt Romney, who clearly is not making any jobs, right? I mean, he was campaigning last year. I guess he's making jobs in his own campaign. But he is not a job creator. He has not even been working for Bain for years. And yet he's making $20 million a year. And I don't hate success. But why is this guy paying a smaller percentage of his taxes? There is no logic to it. And the real question is if President Obama will take this opportunity to at least make a rhetorical argument that there's something really wrong with the idea of a capital gains tax and the idea of people making their money off of investments and getting preferential treatment for it.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here. I mean, I've been begging for them to make this, at the very least, a rhetorical shift, and it should have been a policy shift as well. The rumor is that he is going to speak in much more of this sort of terms in the State of the Union tonight. We'll see. You know, that we've had a lot, you know, what they consider to be, you know, fiery populism often turns out to be a very lukewarm form of, you know, not quite as pro-Wall Street as the other guys. So,
right.
You know, we'll see whether or not that actually happens. It's a good forum for him to do it. It's the launch of the campaign, you know, seriously. And, you know, there's nothing to stop him from going after, you know, both Romney and Newt or the Republican Party in general, the system in general, whatever he wants to do. I mean, he has the forum, he can do it. You know, I'm still skeptical that we're going to see that. I don't know, you undoubtedly read the piece by Ryan Lizza this week in the New Yorker.
I referenced it, and I want to move to that because we also, you have a great post about both Romney in the context of the mortgage crisis and also this deal that is happening. I mean, you know, like my whole interest, although I have been sucked into sort of like this resurgence of Newt, but my whole interest in this presidential primary is basically getting a sense of what openings are there for President Obama to run against rhetorically. I mean, because at the end of the day, I'm firmly in the, you know, we've got basically the midwife to the 1% versus the 1% in this election. but I'm interested in the implications of a broader debate and how Occupy Wall Street can also, seize that narrative that's floating out there. And so we have Mitt Romney, who would be the perfect launching pad for a full-throated populist rhetoric. But there was also something very interesting that you and David Dayen caught in Mitt Romney's sort of round table where he was taking notes with some ordinary Floridians about the mortgage crisis. You caught a couple of things in there. Tell me about what Mitt Romney said that was sort of stunning and maybe not on purpose. Because, you know, the best thing about Romney right now is he seems to be completely floundering for a message. And so he's saying things that I don't think he means to say.
Yeah, I don't think he has a clue about this particular issue, for one thing. I mean, I think people give Romney way too much credit, to be honest, for being, you know, a super smart, together guy who really gets the issues. I don't see the evidence for that. I mean, he's a competent politician, but he's not brilliant. And I don't think he has any kind of a feel for the kind of issues that are coming up. Despite his business experience, I don't think he knows anything about the, you know, foreclosure crisis. At least that's my sense from every time I hear him talk about it. And what he said down there in Florida was essentially, you know, he was talking with some people who were saying, you know, we're underwater with debt. Now, granted, some of the people he was talking to sounded a little real estate speculator-ish to me, but just for the purpose of argument, that these are ordinary people with you know, burdened with, you know, they're underwater in these mortgages. And his answer to them was, you know, I've rarely heard anybody say this, which is, you know, sometimes it's best to walk away. Basically, that's what he said. Now, we've been told from the very beginning of this that any hint of strategic default for ordinary Americans was a terrible moral hazard. And, you know, this would set an awful precedent. The banking system would go down. People walk away from their mortgage. It's the worst possible thing. Meanwhile, of course, wealthy people go bankrupt all the time and walk away from their debts. This is not a problem for them.
Romney's bank capital made millions upon over-leveraging these companies, using these subsidiaries as basically a pass-through for tax benefit, and walked away from these bankruptcies with a ton of money, almost going in knowing that they were going to over-leverage these companies. I mean,
I don't think there's any doubt that they know going in that they're going to do it. And, I mean, that's kind of the very essence of vulture capitalism. You know, you go in, you drain whatever assets there are, and then you walk away from the debt that you've created. I mean, this is totally normal, everyday process in the business world. But that has not been extended to average Americans in their main investment in life, which is real estate. Most middle-class people, that's their biggest investment, is their home. And this was very strange. Now, my assumption is, reading this, I was kind of, it was kind of breathtaking. I'm going, wow, Mitt Romney said this. And then you go and you read a little bit further and you realize he's talking about, you know, how, you know, the banks have to give up, you know, they have to write down all of these things. And I'm realizing, I don't think he really understands what he's saying here. But it doesn't really matter, because if the president and the administration managed to pull off this terrible deal, this deal with the banks on foreclosures, including all 50 states. There are some 3 AGs that I know of, maybe some more, who are holding out because it's such a bad deal, essentially letting the banks off the hook.
Yeah, let's back up for a second. People know, I think people of this program are familiar. We've talked about this in the past. There was an attempt by the state's attorney generals, headed by Indiana's attorney general, to basically come to a deal with the banks which would let them off for peanuts, stop investigations, essentially, and give them indemnity across the states. You got Schneiderman in New York. You got Camila,
Harris in California.
In California, and I think one in
Biden in Delaware.
In Delaware, who have basically said, we're not part of this. And those are particularly New York and California, but Delaware in some respects too, because there's some industry there. They're not part of it. There's a lot of foreclosures there, so there's a lot of investigation. But the administration has been hammering these attorney generals to accept that deal, and now they have a new deal. Is it a new deal or is it the same deal?
Well, I to be honest with you, I am not sure. The details of this particular, it's not even a negotiation. It's just, you know, they're basically handing the states, you know, a take it or leave it kind of agreement. The deal, as I understand it, is something like what it will end up being $20 billion. That the banks will have to pay, which sounds like a lot of money. But the truth is that, I mean, even if you compare it to the bonuses that that CEOs of banks throughout the country have made in the past year, it's like something like $110 billion. So it's not like this is going to really bankrupt the banks. And in essence, what it's doing is letting them off very, very easy.
And more importantly, I think that we're talking about $300 billion worth of mortgages that need to be squared in terms of the consumers. And so the whatever it is, the $17 billion that would go towards reducing the principal for these struggling homeowners is literally about $280 billion shy of what is needed.
Yeah. And so, you know, essentially, so the burden of all of this will end up being felt by the, you know, by the taxpayers, the citizens, not the banks. They're going to get off easy, be able to pay for their bonuses without, you know, breaking a sweat. And you know, I think a lot of people just say, why is the administration doing this? I mean, it kind of doesn't even make sense on a, it certainly doesn't make sense on a political level if people ever figure out what happened here. And if Mitt Romney, going back to our original point here, Mitt Romney, either cluelessly or consciously taking this position down there in Florida, which, I mean, that's ground zero for, you know, foreclosure
right.
fraud. He, you know, him taking that position positions him basically on the populist left side of the president in the, you know, one of the biggest, on one of the biggest issues of this campaign. And I find it hard to believe that he's, you know, I didn't get the sense from it that this was a conscious thing, but it might end up happening. It is a very, very politically ignorant thing for the administration to take this position now. It leaves them wide open to the Republicans coming in and taking the populist side on this, and it leaves the administration stuck way out there. And the only thing I can think of, I mean, I guess they want to get, they want to do, you know, do a, you know, what do they keep saying? There's a phrase for it. It's, you know, a restart or a reset.
Right.
You know, so they want to reset the housing market. Well, you know, I don't really think it's as simple as flipping a switch. And I think that the idea that they can do that by just, you know, doing one big sweeping deal, which evidently the president wanted to announce in the State of the Union tonight, and I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I've not heard that it is. So perhaps the holdout of the three states has actually, you know, stalled them from making this big announcement. But I think it's politically, you know, insane to do this. I mean, it doesn't make and forget, you know, of course, on the policy, it's
right.
Horrible.
I think 5 or 6 years from now, depending on whether or not Obama has a second term, we're going to find out what the real story is behind this. There is some type of intense pressure point because the doggedness. I mean, if you compare the doggedness in which they've thrown out Sean Donovan from HUD to pursue this deal with the complete absence of doggedness that the Department of Justice has exercised, there's something here. Now, the question is, the only way this will get on the table during the campaign is if someone like Mitt Romney raises it, or, you know, Newt Gingrich is smart enough and shameless enough to bring this up if he becomes the general nominee. But I wanted to go back to Mitt for a second, because the interesting thing about Mitt Romney is 5 months ago when we spoke about Mitt Romney, I remember that ad that he had where he was talking about the bump in the road I mentioned this yesterday with Steve Kornacki. 5-6 months ago, Mitt Romney was staking out this sort of populist middle class ground by saying, you know, President Obama doesn't appreciate with the, you know, he's calling unemployment bump in the road and that type of thing.
Right.
He's completely lost it now, but he stumbles back on this foreclosure thing, which would be fantastic. But of course, if he actually pursued that, he would lose all of the establishment support from Republicans.
It would never happen. I mean, that's why it was such a bizarre and shocking thing to read. I'm going, what? And why I believe he didn't know what he was saying. Because it is completely antithetical to everything, any Republican. I mean, we're not even the moderates. I mean, there's nobody in the Democratic Party who's right. arguing for what Mitt Romney was arguing for. I'm not even sure. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I don't know if I've even heard him argue for this. I mean, it's the right thing to do. I'm a big believer in strategic default myself. The hell with these banks, you know.
Right.
I walk away, baby. You know, everybody else can. You want capitalism? Here's capitalism. You know, this is what happens.
There's a weird morality like afoot in there. Like for individuals, there is some notion of like you are somehow immoral. If you just you have an underwater mortgage, you send in the bank won't let you do a short sale and get out from under this. You send in your keys to them and just say, here, it's yours. We don't even have to go through, you know, start the foreclosure proceedings. Bye bye. I'm just walking away.
And it's not like they don't pay a price for that. I mean, this is the part that I don't understand. Your credit
right.
is effectively destroyed
yep.
for, you know, close to 10 years. Right. You will pay a huge price for walking away from a debt like that. The same, you know, but the concept of it is rational capitalistic thinking. When you are underwater on a house, it makes zero sense for you to pay that money. That is an irrational thing for you to do. To do it purely on, well, I signed a contract. Yeah, and the contract said that if you walked away, your credit would be destroyed for, you know, 10 years. That's how this, you know, the larger contract involved here. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is the way it's done in business everywhere. But some guy who bought a house, you know, some family in Florida who bought a house for $200,000, and now it's worth, you know, $75,000. They're on the hook for the rest of their lives. You know, that's just wrong with that. There's something wrong with that. It makes no sense. So, you know, I think what Romney was saying, basically, yes, we need a reset and we've gotten a way to do it. You know, sometimes you just have to walk away. He's saying, wow, Mitt, awesome. But, you know, he's saying that from the perspective of Bain Capital. Not
right,
from the
exactly.
perspective of some
do.
Guy. Yeah, this is what they do, of course. But he just doesn't realize that ordinary people aren't allowed to do that. That's like, you know, considered to be, you know, a horrible thing. They have, you know, it's a moral hazard. The entire system will collapse if ordinary people do what Bain Capital does.
You know, it's interesting because it just that whole sort of conversation, there was a piece in the New York Times maybe it was over the weekend, that a new study shows that black people are twice as likely as white people to wind up in there are two types of bankruptcy for individuals, Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, and they are twice as likely to wind up in Chapter 13, which is a much more onerous sort of type of bankruptcy where you basically don't walk away from as many obligations.
Yeah, you're stuck.
And for some reason, lawyers across the country push black people into Chapter 13 at twice the rate they do for whites, controlling for everything else. And it has to do, supposedly, according to like one thing, was that it had to do with, like, you know, black people have more, you know, take this stuff more seriously. They have a different set of values.
What?
I mean, I honestly cannot. There is no. There has to do with their perception of their responsibility
wow.
within this world, within this financial world, and I think there is clearly a dynamic and a conversation that is not being held. That when you see a guy like Mitt Romney paying, you know, 13%, 14% on $24 million, where he can say very casually, it's irrational to do anything except for mail your keys in. He can say this because he's on top of the heap. There
yeah.
is some type of moral construct that is embedded into our whole financial system that somehow the less, if your status is somehow less, then this controls for finances, even for black people. So I suspect it has something to do more with a mentality that actually goes beyond their present circumstances, that you are more obligated to the system.
Wow. Well, you know, I mean, if one were to listen to, you know, the people who are in charge, they would say, absolutely, that's correct. You are obligated to the system. The system, you know, this is what you have to do. I would imagine that for African Americans who have worked hard to buy themselves a home and have this asset and build up, you know, some kind of a nest egg and find themselves in this awful situation, probably in many of their minds, they're thinking, if I lose my step on this ladder, I'm not going to get back up on here. You know, maybe it's the idea that they are, you know, clinging to their hold on the middle class, you know, people whose parents were perhaps, you know, not very well off, or people who came up on their own, you know, if they're coming out of poverty. I would imagine that, you know, you'd be scared to death that you're going to lose everything and lose your, you know, lose your ability to ever get it back again,
right,
because you have this black mark on your record and, you know, suddenly you're a deadbeat. You know, you have more, you know, Newt Gingrich is going to be calling you names. You know, they're screaming Fannie, Freddie, Acorn every 5 minutes, and you know what they're talking about. So, you know, I guess I'm not surprised, but that's kind of tragic, really. I mean, it's tragic because Chapter 13 is horrible for average people. They might as well be in debtor's prison. It's an endless, you know, debt. It strings out forever. They can never, you know, it takes them 10 times as long to get back to where they were as it does with a Chapter 7 reset.
Yeah. I think there's just something where I think, frankly, like wealthy people and people who have grown up in generations of wealth. I mean, despite the fact that Mitt Romney talks about how he's a self-made man, I got to imagine having a father who's a senator and a president of a major car company sort of gives you just a little bit of a leg up. I mean,
yeah, you think maybe that it opens a couple doors if your name is Romney and you go to Harvard.
And I think even there's like a socialization that takes place where you start to see the world as your relationship to the world is different. You are no longer, you see yourself as a master of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even a function of where you are financially. It is simply your perception of what you can manipulate. And I think that there are people on both the, you know, the middle class level and also from a social level that don't have that same perception. And so the idea of mailing in those keys, you know, to a guy like Romney, it's just a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they? They're just the banks. But I think for average people, there's an intimidation. Now, there's one more thing I want to touch on, and I don't know if you've seen this, but the specificity about Romney, he had his Swiss bank accounts closed in 2010. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the deal that the feds made with UBS and Credit Suisse for people who were evading taxes, their clients who were evading taxes by opening up Swiss bank accounts? They basically had a repatriation safe harbor. If you bring your money back, we'll just charge you some fines and there won't be any real criminal proceedings. Have you heard anything about that?
You know what? Vaguely, I had heard about it. And in fact, what I heard about it was in the context of the new proposed Repatriation Act, which they've been talking about for the past year, where they were also doing, you know, it was this, what was it called, the Repatriation Holiday or something?
Right.
Where
they, it was the American Jobs Creation
right.
Act when Bush did it in 2004. Didn't
right.
quite work out that way, but
right. And that whole thing of, you know, yes, bring your money back and we'll just, you know, we'll call it a wash. You know, I had heard something vaguely about it. Is there a suspicion that Romney may have been involved
well,
in that?
Well, this would have happened in 2009, and this is different than this than the corporate repatriation because the
sure.
corporate profits are legal. What they were talking about is this was tax evasion. And we want that money back here. We want to shut down that operation. So we're going to give you basically like, you know.
Amnesty.
Yeah, hand your gun in and mm-hmm. we'll give you a toy, you know, we'll give you a toy for Christmas and we'll call it even, essentially. But you got to wonder, if you're releasing 2010, it shows you made $24 million. You only paid 13.9% tax. What's in 2009 that you're worried about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think he's going to escape that question, do you? I mean, this is going to dog him, and he's I don't get the sense that there is a reason why he didn't just lay out all,
yeah.
you know, 10 years worth. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The guy has been running for office pretty much the whole time. Everybody knows he's vastly wealthy. If everything was on the up and up, why release 2 years and not the ones before?
You go back to every time he's been asked that question, the past two times, the first time with his father, I think people thought it was his father's, you know, George Romney, you know, released 12 years of taxes because he said any 1 year can be a fluke.
Right.
But if you look at his response to the question last night, it literally is if they are sitting in the green room with him going like, remember, if the truth about your taxes comes out, it's all over. So
you
just be confident
done.
When you answer that question. Because he falls apart during that question. I mean, I you know, as an actor, this is the one thing he cannot go there.
He can't.
I can see that. And
yeah.
There's something there. And it's sad that we have to rely on Newt Gingrich to be the only guy who's going to dog him about it.
God, no kidding. No kidding. And, you know, this has always been, I mean, one of the things people go, oh, you know, the Newt surge and it's all so shocking and blah, blah, blah. I mean, haven't we been talking from the beginning that there was supposed to be an anti-Romney? I mean, I think most people assumed it'd be somebody better than Newt, but it turned out there wasn't anybody better than Newt. They were all so bad. You know, they tried everybody else out, and Santorum's still getting a little bit of a hearing. I mean, you know, I guess if Newt totally falls apart, maybe they'll turn to him. But the truth is that, you know, Romney cannot close this deal, and I'm not entirely sure that he'll be able to. I mean, if he does, it's going to be a much dicier sort of win than it was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'll tell you something, Sam. I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts about American elections is every single time, every 4 years, presidency specifically, people make the assumption months and months and months in advance who's going to win. And then when it, you know, they won't wait for people to vote until they start telling other people to drop out. I mean, this whole punditry thing, and I'm in it too, and so are you. But, mm-hmm. you know, the idea that you don't wait to see how this stuff plays out, it creates, it contributes to the narrative of these campaigns in a way that I think is kind of undemocratic. Everyone should shut up and let voters choose.
Yeah,
that's my feel.
I agree with that. I think in the final analysis of the many undemocratic forces that impact our elections, I don't know if that's the most egregious. And you know, I had wanted to talk to you about Citizens United, because you had a great piece up there and you made the point that people don't understand that Sheldon Adelson. I think is his name, when he gave that $5 million to to Newt Gingrich to essentially change the tenor of the race so he could come back and create that wonderful anti-Bain movie, which I now play in my home on a loop. that money, he could have given that money any other year. It wasn't contingent upon Citizen United. It was strictly a function of Buckley v. Valeo, which was a 1976 ruling. And if I'm not mistaken, it was one of Lewis Powell's, one of his 5-4 decisions, which, fulfilled his famous Powell memo. But that's been out there already. It just seems that I think you said it well in your piece that culturally the money's just flying in a different way and these people are richer.
I really think, it's an under-discussed aspect of this, which is that it seems to me in the 1%, they have so much more money than they did before. I put up a graph of the Koch brothers since 2007, I think. I mean, their wealth has gone up exponentially. It's outrageous. It's literally unbelievable how much more wealthy they are just in the last 5 years than where they were. When you have that kind of money, they're worth, you know, what is it? You know, I don't know how many billions, but they are able to, $5 million is nothing to people like that. Sheldon Adelson is he's the eighth richest man in America. $10 million of his personal fortune is nothing. That is a big change. I mean, people say, well, you know, they didn't want to put their names on it. I don't see the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson upset about their names being on this. I don't think they care. That's part of the cultural
thing. I think they like it.
It's the battle of the titans, right?
Sheldon Adelson is sitting in his office right now going like, I did that.
Yeah, it's Sheldon versus Romney's guy.
I did that. It's not
Romney's guy is John Paulson, right? Yep. I mean, he's his biggest friend. So he's, you know, it's Paulson versus Adelson. That's who's running in this election, basically.
I think it's two plutocrats running in this election. I think this is why too much time is spent on Citizens United, because I think you're absolutely right. This is when we talk about the danger of a plutonomy turning into a plutocracy. This is what we mean. When you have people with so much extra money, so much overcapacity, that they start to turn around. And we saw one of the problems was they had all this free money from the Fed in the early 2000s. And so you see them take advantage of the lax regulation and start to, you know, go to the horse races with it. But the other aspect of it is when you have this much wealth controlled by so few private individuals, they start going like, hey, there's not enough first sinks in the world for me to buy.
Exactly.
I'm just going to start to change all of our politics, and I can do that where, you know, like when I go, literally when I go across the street to buy a sandwich, I spend more time thinking about should I buy the $7 one or the $5 one than this guy does about dropping $5 million to change the course of the GOP primary.
Absolutely. This is, you know, this is tip money to these people. It is not a lot of money. It's an incredibly great investment. The return on this money, well, you can already see by looking at the Koch brothers.
Right.
The return on their investment is huge. It's unbelievable. The rest of us, of course, we're being drained. I mean, the rest of the nation's being drained of its wealth. It's all going to the very top now. And it just gets worse and worse. It builds on itself. And I think that change, the income inequality just being so completely out of control, combined with a cultural shift that is, you know, people like Paul Ryan, this new resurgence of, you know, Ayn Randism and all of that. I mean, this worship of money at the top. And then, of course, we have the blowback on that, which is Occupy and,
right.
and you know, average people sort of looking around going, what the hell happened? And we're in a situation where our politics are now being completely dominated, openly dominated by big money.
Yeah. And so, I don't even think it's a question of return on their money in terms of like investment. I think that's partly there. I think that's the cherry on top. I think the rest of it is really more like, look how much of the world I can control.
Yep.
That's why they make money in the first place. And when they're spending $5 million and he says, like, I can change the outcome of the South Carolina election and seriously change the tenor of the GOP primary for only $5 million bucks. Are you kidding me? That's like the functional equivalent of me finally saying, like, I'm going to spend, you know, $800 and I'm going to look at that new TV every day. That makes me feel good. This guy, $5 million and I can control the American government.
More do you want? I mean, you know, I shall rule the world. I mean, that's basically what they're doing. You know, it's Goldfinger.
Right. It's true. Well, Digby, wonderful speaking to you as always. Folks, Digby's blog at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sam. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
All right, folks. Well, we've gone well over today. And folks, hold up. Stop music for one second. I got an email the other day that said, you know what you should do to raise money for your show is you should advertise on the free podcast. Well, this is a bee in my bonnet right now, because we actually, when we first looked into this, we were told you need a basic minimum of downloads. We have over 12 times, maybe 13 or 14 times that basic minimum, but we cannot get advertising on our free podcast. And it is a function of the content. Now, advertisers generally don't say, like, this is not a show I would listen to. No, we had the same problem at Air America. That's how we ended up on, it wasn't as nefarious as it sounds, but a blacklist. People don't want to be associated with politics, particularly politics that sit here and hammer wealthy people. And by wealthy people, I mean the Adelsons and the Romneys of the world. They don't want to hear somebody who's talking about corporate malfeasance. They don't want to hear these things. And they don't want to be associated. I don't think it's nefarious. They don't want to silence me. They just don't want to associate it with it. Well, the end of the day is that we leave a lot of money on the table because we don't have access to it, which is why on this program we rely on members so much. And frankly, I'm not even keeping track of projections anymore because we are so far behind what we had projected we would be at. And those projections were just based upon, you know, what it would take to keep this show going and to be able to maintain a staff and be able to do this long term. So, you know, we have there are thousands upon thousands of you who listen on a daily basis. So if you have the opportunity to support the program, keep it alive, please do. You can become a member at majority.fm. There's just simply not a lot of opportunity to monetize these things. And it's not a function because there isn't an audience, because I can see the audience. I can see that we have an audience that is literally over 10 12, 15 times greater than a show that would be talking about, gadgets or, entertainment or, you know, Brangelina or whatever it is, would be getting those same ads. But they're just not available to us. And so it is your support that we need on this program. And so I make an appeal to you. Become a member today. You get a shofar blast. You get free DVDs. Undying gratitude. Sense of pride. You don't have $5 million to change the outcome of the South Carolina Republican primary. But for a fraction so small that I can't even calculate it, you can feel the pride of walking around saying that you are keeping a daily show alive. And perhaps maybe even fueling my opening a Swiss bank account. All right, got to go to the better half of the program. I'll be talking about Rick Santorum's new devastating fundraising. Oh, gosh. It's unbelievable. More on this California single payer. Go to majority.fm to get more information, and we'll send you to a link at Daily Kos that will tell you how to get involved. I'll go through that zombie lie, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac crash, the story of the whistleblower. May get to it today, may get to it tomorrow. Folks, we need your support. See you in the better half of the program. You can call me, 646-257-3920. I am me at Majority FM. We'll be right back.